Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 8th of February. Monday at 9 is All Things Political, and we're happy to have as our guest from the University of Miami, Professor Gregory Koger. He specializes in the study of Congress, political parties, interest groups, elections, political history, and political institutions. And this is great because I don't know a whole lot about the history of the filibuster and why it's being used so extensively now and when it was used less extensively in the past. He has published research on filibustering, legislative parties, congressional rules, and bill co-sponsorship in the U.S. House. He has a forthcoming book from the University of Chicago Press, which is entitled Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate, which will be available this June. And he's done a number of media appearances and published summaries of his work for broad audiences. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him as we talk about a number of issues. Partisanship in Washington, certainly front and center. We will also be talking about the president deciding that he's going to have bipartisan discussions about health care reform in this country. We'll talk about the Tea Party convention, which took place over the weekend, and many more issues. So here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. We have a new assistant producer joining us today. She started on Friday, but she'll be with you answering phones this morning. So welcome Chrissy Peace to the station. She's been here before, but she'll be with us and working on our shows and doing on-air production and production and a number of things. So welcome her as you call in today. So we meet Professor Gregory Koger. Hi.
Hi, and thank you for having me on the air.
Yeah, our great pleasure. I'm so ready to hear the information that you're going to give us because it's a lack of knowledge that I have, and I know that it's making everything a little bit more difficult in Washington these days. So why don't we start with the filibuster? Can you give me sort of a history of 101 of why it is used so extensively now and when it wasn't and when it started to be used extensively and all of that?
Sure. Basically, filibuster is the extraordinary use of ordinary tactics, right? So every legislator has a right to speak or to make motions. And so we say the legislator is filibustering when he or she talks for a very long time or makes a lot of motions. And that has always been around to some extent. So the big change I think that you're wondering about is, when did it become so common? And the answer there is it started in the 1960s and 1970s to become more of an everyday occurrence in the U.S. Senate. Before then, you actually had to stand up and speak or make motions and actually chew up hours and hours of the Senate's time. And then in the 60s, they said, well, that's just a waste of time. You know, we'd rather be doing other things. We've got other topics to work on. So if you threaten to filibuster, we are going to see if we have the votes to cut it off using the Senate's cloture rule, which requires these days 60% of the Senate to vote aye, to shut off debate, and then you can actually vote on a bill or nomination. So once senators made that strategic change, right, so instead of, you know, waiting for somebody to be exhausted, we'll just vote, see if we have the votes to shut it off, that changed everybody's calculations. So there's now very little cost in threatening a nomination or a bill, and so everybody does it. Mm-hmm. So the short answer to your question is that things changed in the 60s and 70s, and then since then there's been a gradual upwards trend in the increasing use of the power to obstruct.
And when we hear these days that you have to have 60 votes to pass virtually anything, when did that happen?
Well, right. So this happens in the 60s and 70s when it becomes known that if somebody tries to filibuster, you need the votes to invoke cloture.
So what's happening is people are threatening to filibuster over just about everything?
That's right. Hmm. And you know, there's a gradual process by which people sort of, their mindsets change in the Senate, and they say, well, you know, it used to be we only fought over certain things, and then now we're going to fight over everything this way. So the change has been gradual in the way that senators use this power. But the fundamental change occurred in the 60s and 70s. But along the way, we still mark milestones. Like, nobody's ever done that before.
Right.
So this last week, right, one of these milestones was we found out that Richard Shelby, a Republican senator from Alabama, he's threatened every single executive branch nomination, and because he wants bargaining leverage to get some money, basically his money from Alabama. So nobody's ever done that. Just sort of blocked every single nomination for an unrelated issue.
And the issue is that he has a proposed contract involving some kind of tanker and is saying that the president is not, according to Shelby, addressing national security concerns. And he, Senator Shelby, would be willing to discuss all of this with the president, right?
Right, right. Yeah, he wants the FBI to build a counterterrorism center in Alabama, and then the thing with the tanker, it's actually a dispute that goes on for several years. It hasn't gone on for several years. The underlying question is which really large defense firm is going to get the contract to build more air refueling tankers for the Air Force. Boeing lost out on that competition, I don't know, 5, 6, 8 years ago. And the Air Force wanted to give them a second chance to win the contract. And Shelby doesn't want that because the contractor that's located in Alabama would otherwise get the contract.
Considering the level of partisanship in Washington right now, his hold has been described as a rare thing. Do you think that this may become more commonplace?
Well, certainly if he gets away with it. I mean, the lesson there is that if you want anything, then you can just block every nomination and force the other party, the president, to come to you. So if he succeeds, then every other senator would learn the lesson that this is fair play. Now, what's interesting about this is that the holds, which normally are private information, right? Senators don't tell everybody about their holds, and some of them are kept completely secret. The fact that Shelby had made this threat and he was blocking all those nominations became public knowledge, I believe, out of Senator Harry Reid's office, the Senate Majority Leader's office. So the fact that it was divulged is also interesting. That there's some trust that goes on in allowing somebody to basically have a secret filibuster. Mm-hmm. And if the Democrats are going to start divulging who's blocking what, that in itself could change the political calculations a little bit.
When have filibusters been used for terrible purposes, and when have they been used for the good of all?
Oh, that is not the sort of question I can answer. I mean, the easy answer is that, from 1891 to 1965, there was a series of filibusters against civil rights legislation that in hindsight we say, well, that's awful. You know, that kept our country from making real progress on civil rights. So that's an easy answer. So a good filibuster is one where among other things, so you've got like a really powerful interest group or like a party that says we need to pass X bill, this certain bill, and the people senators who are beholden to that interest group or they're members of that party, they privately don't think it's a very good idea, but politically it's awkward for them to come out publicly and vote against it. So a good filibuster blocks that kind of legislation, sort of keeps the Senate from being the tool of some outside interest. And so when senators talk about the filibuster, one thing they like about it is the fact that they can get a lot of leverage on things that are important to just them, as Shelby's done to a great extent. And the other reason is because sometimes there are bad legislative ideas that have a lot of political force behind them, and the filibuster makes it a little bit easier for the Senate to resist those bad ideas.
The president has said, as you know, if you're going to need 60 votes in order to accomplish anything in this country, then you have got to meet with me and we need to talk about important issues together, like health care legislation or the major things that he wants to pay attention to. Is he right about that? Does somebody have to give here and negotiate in good faith?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a great move. The filibuster is bad for the country to the extent that it allows the minority party to block legislation, while at the same time that the rest of us expect the majority party to accomplish something. So by making it clear that under the current rules, a minority party is essentially the junior partner in governing, it helps to highlight that the responsibility for outcomes is shared, and that, you know, if nothing gets done, then the Republicans are to blame as much as the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And changing their idea, right? So in 2009, I think there were some attempts at, you know, bipartisan negotiation on the part of the Democrats, but mostly it was sort of behind closed doors and let's sit quietly and meet. And a lot of those backdoor negotiations didn't go very far because Republicans are just coming from a completely different place in terms of policy ideas. So to hold the negotiations in public sort of forces the minority party to be responsible for coming up and presenting with their own ideas and then having to respond openly to what the Democrats have in mind. And if they are being obstructionist for political reasons, then that will be readily apparent if they're having a conversation in front of the cameras.
And do they have to show up for those meetings, and could they block having it televised?
Do they have to? I mean, they could. Well, that's the thing. So President Obama has proposed, for example, that that he and the Republicans sit down and have a conversation about health care on February 25th. The Republicans could say no, but then that no would be a very public rejection. It's saying we don't want to sit down and talk about this, or we don't want the television cameras there. So it's a lose-lose for them. If they sit down with President Obama, there's a good chance that he will be perceived as the winner. And if they don't agree to the meeting or they don't agree to having the television cameras there, then they will also be perceived as a loser.
Mm-hmm. What is it, do you think, that's going to break this logjam? Otherwise, not very much is going to get done. And I really don't think that the American people want that. They want people to get together and hash out their differences and come up with meaningful legislation. They want something to happen.
Yeah. I think what it takes is some sort of the Republicans believing that they are paying a political price for their strategy. This fight last week over Shelby's holds, that might be a crack in the dam. I would think that for the Republicans to block any sort of banking reform legislation has got to be politically that's unsustainable. That, mm-hmm. I mean, after what we've gone through over the last 2 years, to just say, no, I don't want banking reform legislation because the banking lobby says no. I mean, that's not the position of the Republicans, but I mean, that is – they risk appearing to take that position. And if banking reform doesn't pass, I think that's the sort of thing that could be hung upon the necks of the Republicans. In this new Senate, when mm-hmm. they have 41 votes to block things.
And tell me a little bit more, please, before we go to phone calls, about this process of reconciliation, when it can be used.
Reconciliation can be used to change the current law so it conforms to the Democrats' budget, or to the Congress's budget. And it can only be used on budgetary things. So last year, there was a lot of talk about passing healthcare reform as a budget reconciliation legislation. But there's a lot of the Democrats' healthcare ideas were not budgetary, right? So imposing regulations on insurance companies is not directly related to the budget. So that couldn't pass as normal budget reconciliation. The plus side, and the reason the Democrats were talking about it, is that budget reconciliation legislation can't be filibustered in the Senate. There's a time limit on debate, and so, you know, once that time is used up, then there's a simple majority vote to pass it or not pass it.
Okay. Do you think that it would be wise for the Democrats to use reconciliation on health care reform and possibly on other bills, or does that then add to their perception of being obstructionist or taking the ball and running with it when they need to be bipartisan as well?
As a legislative matter, I think it would be fair for Democrats to do it. I mean, it's clear that they have attempted to work, you know, to attract some Republican votes. And it's clear that using the regular rules of the Senate would make it very difficult to pass health care reform. As a political matter, I don't know that it would be in their best interests. One of the outcomes of the Massachusetts senatorial election, which brought Scott Brown to the Senate, was the Democrats, I think, were quite shaken about their own political futures. And so just coming up with 51 votes to pass, serious health care reform through the Senate might be difficult. I mean, at the end of the day, you still need at least some Senate moderates, Democratic moderates, to vote for that package. And they may be reluctant to risk their political futures after seeing the Republicans take a Senate seat in Massachusetts.
Right. Professor Gregory Kolger is our guest this hour. He is a professor of American politics at the University of Miami, specializes in study of Congress, political parties, interest groups, elections, political history, and institutions. And he is the author of a forthcoming book, Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. It's all things political for this hour. We're welcoming your phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you're very welcome to do that. That address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Heart Month. The second hour of our program today will be focusing on keeping your heart healthy with a special emphasis on checking your cholesterol and knowing what those numbers mean and whether or not everybody should be on statins, as some suggested a few months ago, that maybe that would be a good thing for all of us to have statins in the drinking water. We'll talk about when you should have your cholesterol checked and what childhood obesity may be doing to heart disease in the future. All right, we welcome phone calls. Let's go to Dave from Ellison Bay first. Hi, Dave.
Well, thank you. Good morning. I've been paying fairly close attention to national politics since 1972 when I was first old enough to vote in a presidential election. And I frankly think that the American people need to be skeptical of both parties, especially as they enter these, whether they're closed door or in front of the television camera, negotiations about health care. Because I think it's real. I mean, if you look over, say, the last 30 or 40 years of American politics, I think unless you're just plainly a partisan, it's hard to put the blame on where this country has gone wrong on one party. So, you know, again, whether it's closed doors or out in the public, it seems as though both parties, while their ideologies may differ in you know, what appear to be significant ways, they both have political agendas that seem more concerned about party success or party control than the good of the American public. You know, trillions and trillions of dollars of debt and things seemingly becoming, well, virtually unmanageable at the federal level and not much better at the state level. It seems to me, if your guest is, you know, essentially putting the onus on the Republicans as the minority party now, just seems a little unrealistic, so I'd like to hear your comments about that.
All right. Professor?
Right. I think Dave gets at something that is pretty widespread, which is skepticism about the ability of both parties to govern. For me, I mean, one of the interesting angles on this is political history, right? We've been through a banking crisis. At the same time, we're in the middle of, two overseas wars and a recession. And historically, these are the sorts of things that cause people to distrust their leadership, particularly banking crises, right? Because it's something that makes us feel disempowered And we, you know, and we sense that in a lot of that, in, to some extent, the government is responsible for regulating banks. And then, when there is a failure of the banking system or wars that don't work out, we think we it's historically common to blame our leadership and both sides. So if you look back over the last, you know, 5 to 8 years, it's fair to say that both parties were at least partially responsible for the problems that we face. I mean, part of our first conversation was about how now the Republicans are, you know, bear partial responsibility for what happens to the country because they have 41 votes in the Senate. And the same argument can be made about Democrats in the during the Bush administration, that they had the votes to block a lot of the things that went through, or at least in the case of tax cuts, you know, could have complained much louder about what the long-term budgetary implications of the tax cuts would be.
Why didn't they?
Well, in 2001, remember, there was a very large budget surplus. It's hard to remember that now.
That's right.
But there was a large budget surplus, and the argument that, you know, and when we have the surplus, it's, you know, it's fair to return the money to American taxpayers. That was fair. And, you know, the Republicans had won the election of 2000 by a slender margin, but they, you know, they'd gained control of the you know, governing institutions. And so it seemed fair at the time to let them implement their agenda. And they used, I should mention, the budget reconciliation process to get their 2001 tax cuts through. So they only needed 51 votes in the Senate.
Right. Thank you, Dave, for your call. We go to Carl from Madison next. Hi, Carl.
Howdy.
Hi.
Kathleen and Professor, I admit to being a staunch progressive. Excuse me. And I'm... By the same token, I'm appalled by both parties. It seems like there's just too much money. I mean, it is egregious coming in from the healthcare industry, especially the insurance companies. Now, my question is the following. I still understand that it would help at least initially. I think people would love, you know, some sort of a single payer or public option. But to get this thing rolling and to let everybody understand what's going on, because I don't think most people do with the legislation, ordinarily it's best they have one large omnibus bill, right, and pass that. But in this situation, what would be wrong with even though it drags the procedure out, breaking it down into, let's say, 12 bills and have a vote on each of those 12 bills, and so that it's discreet, people understand what's at issue, and there can be enough time to see who's who the special interest groups are and who's well, you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, we got it, Carl. I think that's probably likely to happen. What do you think, Professor Kohler?
Well, first, the easy answer, the hindsight is 2020 answer. I think Carl is absolutely – I mean, my thought is that Carl is absolutely right, and that if you could build a time machine, that's what the Democrats should have done in 2009. I think the sheer size of the healthcare reform bill that they were trying to push through Congress was itself a liability. And if you could break it into pieces and the people could understand the individual pieces that are in it, it would be much more understandable and create less suspicion. Now, what should they do in 2010? It seems that is one of the things they seem to be talking about, like breaking out the most popular pieces, such as restrictions on insurance company practices, and passing that as a single bill. Other than that, I honestly don't know what they'll do. Part of this conference between President Obama and the Republicans, I think, is to try to refocus the public's attention on healthcare and try to get something larger through, right? So not just restrictions on insurance companies, but actually expanding healthcare coverage, I think, is what the Democrats need, actually. I mean, having invested everything they've invested, they have to get something out of that effort, or else it'll appear as they're really struggle to govern.
And what do you think the Democrats did wrong? Because they had this majority in the House, majority in the Senate, they've got the White House. Why did the Republicans sort of take this issue and define what was wrong with the bill instead of the Democrats trying to explain to the American people how it would benefit them? They did it wrong, I think.
they did do it wrong. I don't know. I mean, people will probably write books about this now, and because that's what academics do. And those books will be smarter than what I can say right now. But I would think that I mean, one thought I've had based on, you know, the emergence of the Tea Party movement and so forth is that it might have made sense just in terms of marketing the bill to start out by saying this is a bill to cut costs, right? Because 18% of our economy is dedicated to healthcare, and we just can't sustain that, and it restricts our ability to hire people. You know, companies don't want to come here because of the cost. And it's money out of our pocket, essentially. So let's write a bill to reform costs that also, along the way, expands coverage to all the people who are essentially already getting coverage through our system, just really bad health care. And we'll just bring it above board and be honest about it and subsidize people who can't afford it. Mm. But it would have started with cost cutting as the first marketing pitch. And then from there, say, oh, we will also expand coverage. And then, it's, as Carl says, I mean, I think it would have made better sense to pass individual bills, to break up the big bill into individual pieces so that, you know, people can see individual pieces that they like and say, oh, well, that's not so bad. That's,
yes.
That's not radical socialism. That's just good, you know, common sense healthcare reform. One last thing. The argument
sure.
against that, to be fair, is that everything that the Democrats were talking about was interrelated. So you can't just, say that healthcare insurance companies can't exclude people from their policies without doing something else, or without doing other things to keep insurance companies from just jacking up the rates on everybody. So that the underlying argument is that all these things are interrelated, and so that's why it all had to be in one big bill. But there are creative ways around that, right? You could vote on 12 different bills and then at the end stitch them all back together at the last moment. So it all gets signed as one big bill.
Let's go to an email. John from Milwaukee. Could you please explain, does anybody keep a record of Senate filibuster threats over the years? Are Republicans or Democrats more likely to threaten a Senate filibuster? Are they just a party thing? Have there ever been any bipartisan filibuster threats?
Okay. The holds that we were talking about earlier, I've tried really hard. There's no record of that for long periods of time. Larry Evans at William & Mary did write a paper where he found and Dan Lipinski, his co-author, they wrote a paper where they found records of holds from the 1980s in the archives of Howard Baker, who was at the time the Senate Majority Leader. And I myself spent a lot of time in the archives of Mike Mansfield, who was the Majority Leader from 1961 to 1977. But there were no records of holds there, just like an occasional letter from a senator, but no like systematic records. And so the underlying point is that these threats are themselves secret, right? They're communication from one senator to another, or nowadays one senator to about four other senators. But it's all behind closed doors. In fact, my understanding now is that some of these records are kept by the party conferences in the Senate, and then at the end of each Congress, they're burned. So the record is nobody knows like
really?
Who was blocking that bill. Yeah.
Hmm. We go to Paul from Galesville. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Earlier you said that, you've said some things since, that the Republicans got things passed with reconciliation, and you said that Democrats are, after the election in Massachusetts, are worried about their own political futures. But I just keep kind of beating my head against the wall. The Republicans have made it their policy to block anything, just anything, and I think that it's much more politically dangerous for the Democrats to get nothing done than to just grow a backbone and take it on.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one interpretation of the dissatisfaction that's out there is not necessarily that the Democrats are being too liberal. It's just that they're being too calculating. In both parties, you can make this criticism of both parties. But like, if the Democrats invested essentially, six, 7 months in healthcare, that behavior says we think this is the biggest problem facing the country, and we're going to solve it now. And then they lose one election in Massachusetts, and they say, "What a healthcare bill!" It looks too calculating. If it was a huge problem, before January 2010, then it's a huge problem now because nothing's changed in the healthcare system. It's only the political calculations that have changed. So, yeah, there is an argument to be made, and I'm sure people are making it within Democratic circles, that this isn't so much a call for them to moderate as a call for them to govern and actually accomplish things. And if they do have a record of accomplishment to run on, then they'll do better.
I believe, not that it has any chance of passing, that Senator Harkin is introducing again this week a bill to end the filibuster. Does it stand any chance of passing? And what would happen if it just went away?
Let's do the first one. Does it have any chance of passing? No. Harkin's proposal, what it would do is it would lower the threshold for cloture by 3 votes every time you vote on cloture on a particular issue. So you've got your favorite bill on the floor of the Senate, and you file a cloture petition. In order to invoke cloture the first time, 60 votes. But then you file another petition, then when that 2 days later, that only takes 57 votes, and then 54, and then 51. So that's his proposal. And the early reports on that I've seen included a quote from a Senate leadership aide saying, well, we don't have – the Republicans don't seem likely to support that, and so I don't see that we have many options. Because the way the Senate rules are set up is that if a senator is filibustering a proposal to change the Senate rules, then to invoke cloture on that proposal, it requires a super high threshold of 67 votes. And if the Democrats are going to try to change the rules through the regular process, they would need Republican support, and it's unlikely they'll get it.
Thanks, Paul, for your call. We go to Royce from Madison. Hi, Royce.
Good morning. Filibuster is one of the problems with the Senate, but I consider the Senate being totally dysfunctional. And I guess I would propose, I don't know, maybe there is, but I haven't seen it, a website that shows all the bills that are, gone through the House and are pending for the Senate, and also another big area is appointments. I mean, the president comes in, and again, this is not just a Republican-Democratic thing, but the president has like 3,000 positions to fill, and, there have been appointments that are taking months, some even a year to get through. Which is ridiculous, and so to me, there needs to be a website that lists all the bills and that are pending and when the date they've been pending from, and also appointments. When the president made his nomination, and then how long it's taking to get through the Senate.
There must be such a website somewhere, don't you think, Professor Kohler? Maybe you know of one.
I do know of one, actually. It's thomas.loc.gov.
Thomas.loc.gov. Okay.
Right. Thomas, like Thomas Jefferson is is part of where it comes from. And it's operated by the Library of Congress, and it tracks legislation and nominations, if you want to look up nominations. So that's where you can get your list of bills passed by the House and waiting in the Senate. But also, my favorite list of that sort was in the State of the Union address, where President Obama did not come right out and say that the Senate is failing to pass any of the Democrats' legislation. But he did, pay honor to the House for passing things that President Obama wouldn't like the Democrats to act on, like a jobs bill, climate change legislation, a student loan reform was three, and then, of course, health care.
Thanks, Royce, very much for the call. Another email. Please talk about the nuclear option, which I believe was threatened to force Democrats not to block judicial appointments during the Bush years. The VP would break a tie and the filibuster would never be used again.
Depends on what you try to do. So in 2005, yes, Republicans threatened what they call the media called the nuclear option. And what that in that context, what it meant was the Republicans wanted to pass judicial nominations by a simple majority vote. And so what they were going to do was file a cloture petition on a judicial nominee. And if they got, say, 51 votes, then what they would need to do is basically make an appeal of the ruling of the chair that the nomination was blocked and say, actually, no, it only takes 51 votes to pass a judicial nomination. So the underlying point is that the meaning of Senate rules is itself up for debate and up for decision by a simple majority vote, right? So what the Republicans were going to do is reinterpret what the Senate rule says so that for a judicial nomination only takes 51 votes. And the Democrats could do this now, right? So part of my research is on, you know, talking about different ways that a dedicated group of 51 senators could restrict obstruction if they really wanted to. And then the other side of it, though, is figuring out, you know, why hasn't this happened, right? What is it that legislators like Yes. about filibustering so that they don't get so upset that they use the power that is at their fingertips?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry.
Oh, just – I mean, and the short answer is that there are payoffs for working in a system that, when it works well, is, you know, promotes bipartisanship and compromise and, you know, passing laws that will be stable and stick around for a while. And again, that senators gain from a system in which they can get extra leverage on their pet projects. And particularly that senators who are at the middle of the spectrum, moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans, gain from a system where they are essentially the gatekeepers to decide whether or not something goes through. Whereas under system majority rule, say as in the House, it's moderates who pay the biggest price because their part, the moderate members of the majority party are usually sort of voting on what you know, the more extreme members of their own party really want to pass, and then the moderates have to decide between proposals that the party likes and proposals that and on the other that are not necessarily popular in their own districts.
Hmm. Let's pause for just a moment and we'll return. It's All Things Political, as it always is, Monday at 9. Our guest is Professor Gregory Koger. He's from the University of Miami, where he teaches and does research on American politics. He's the author of the forthcoming Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Monday, this is American Heart Month. Our guest, a cardiologist and professor of medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, will join us to talk about cholesterol levels and whether we need to start checking those fairly early in our lives, what those levels mean, how to prevent heart attacks, how to treat yourself after you may have heart disease. Women and heart disease. We'll talk about all of that the second hour of our program. We continue now with Professor Gregory Koger at 800-486-8655. Paul is next from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Yes, thank you. I have to disagree with your guest. When the president talked to the Senate Democrats, he said that you had, talking to the senators, you had to cast more votes to break filibusters last year than the entire 50s and 60s combined. CNN fact-checked that claim, and from 1949 to 1970, there were 30 cloture votes. In 2009, that's just half of this session of Congress, there were 39. Nine more in just 1 year than there were in, oh, let's call it 20 years. So, I mean, it didn't start to grow in the 60s. It grew in about 1975 because they changed the majority rules in 1971. the facts are the Republicans are using cloture and the or they're using the fear of filibuster to keep people from debating the issues. They just simply say no, and nothing moves. It's not a pox on both their houses. It's a pox on the Republicans.
Professor Hoger.
Well, Paul, we're actually in agreement on the idea that there used to be less filibustering in the Senate than there is now. If you're going to go back to 1949 to 1975, sure, that was a period of comparatively low obstruction. The number of cloture votes itself is not necessarily the best measure of how much obstruction is going on, though, because in my research, what I did was I went back and I read through newspaper articles to identify filibusters. Using the New York Times in particular and Time magazine to look for cases where they say there's a filibustering going on. And I use that strategy because the willingness of senators to vote for cloture and even file cloture motions was much lower in the past. So there are a lot of cases where there was a filibuster going on, but nobody would file a petition or vote for it. And especially over the last – but you're right, though. I mean, the number of cloture votes has been much higher over, say, the last 5 years than even, you know, a typical year in the 1980s or the 1990s. Part of that is a greater willingness on the part of the majority party to call the minority party on their bluff and say, well, if you want to filibuster this, you actually have to vote on cloture on it. I'm not going to just sort of walk away from a fight before it begins. And what we get out of that then is a better record of exactly who's for a filibuster and who's against it and how many different things are being blocked. So my point is that the character of the Senate in the system in which anybody can threaten to block anything, that is that's been around for, you know, 30 or some years.
So what would be wrong with using the strategy of letting people have a good filibuster?
If you use the existing rules and procedures, a good live filibuster is harder to fight than it is to conduct, right? So it was a healthcare bill, right? It would take one Republican on the floor at a time giving a speech of, you know, 4, 6, 12 hours about why the healthcare bill was bad. But that one senator at any time could say, I note the absence of a quorum, which means I don't think there are enough people around here to do business.
Right.
And if you note the absence of a quorum, you call for a quorum call. What that means is that the other senators have to prove that there is a majority of the Senate around ready to do business. So the senators who want to pass health care reform, they'd have to be literally on the floor of the Senate or right next door in the cloakroom just in case somebody moves, notes the absence of a quorum. And so there's one speaker against, and, you know, that speaker is paying, you know, a bit of a price. It's his or her time, and it takes, you know, effort to speak. But 50 people who want the bill to pass would have to be immediately in the environment of the chamber, and so they lose sleep and they don't get to do other things with their time, like, you know, hold committee meetings or fundraisers or go back to their states.
Uh-huh. Thanks, Paul, for your call. Marion from Madison. Hi.
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 I'm a very frustrated voter because I vote in every election and they're not doing their job. They're playing a political game, and they're doing it with our lives. I'm very frustrated with this, and I guess when I look at it, my analysis is the Democrats have no courage. They don't try anything. Oh, we might not win, so we're not going to do anything. The Republicans have no heart. They have the, I got mine, the hell with you. And nothing gets done for the people who they're supposed to represent. Instead, we're being sold out to whoever's got the most bucks to put into their campaign funds. And I think that right now, the way they're doing it, they're killing our democracy.
Professor Coker.
That's a tough one to answer. I'll say this. My research on political parties might come across as a little cynical because, I mean, I argue that always, you know, if you go back in time, politicians have always wanted to get reelected, and that's been their primary concern. So if we're going to explain what's going on now, I think what's very frustrating, I think, for everybody who's watching this is that it's not just that they're playing politics, is that achieving something is not politically valued, right? The Democrats on, let's say, healthcare, I mean, right now their behavior says we might be better off doing nothing than actually passing the bill we've talked about and dealing with the problem that we think really exists. And for the Republicans, their behavior says we are better off, you know, trying to keep anything from passing than from sitting down and negotiating and maybe coming up with a bill that we both like. So the idea that they want to get elected is not itself new. But I think what is disheartening is that achieving things, passing legislation, solving problems doesn't seem to have as much reward as it ought to. This morning, just a note of optimism, I was reading an article about climate change legislation and how there is essentially a coalition of actors out there that really want climate change legislation to pass. And it's not just environmentalists. There are businesses that really either they have some stake in the clean energy, or they don't necessarily have a stake in clean energy. They just want to know what the rules are going to be so that they can adjust their practices and their expectations to what the rules are going to be once climate change legislation passes. There are coalitions that want things to pass and that sort of offer political incentives for parties to respond to them. And I think that in the end, that sort of thing will help.
Thank you, Marion, very much for your call. Kurt from it's Jeff from Superior first. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
This is a great topic, Kathleen. Good job. I wanted to get the guest to comment on Congresswoman from Florida, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Is she a rising star in the Democratic Party?
I don't have a lot to say. She seems very competent. I've seen her speak here in Miami, and it's a nice seat for somebody to represent because it seems safely Democratic, so she can be an ardent Democrat and work for the interests of her party and her constituents and her state all at the same time without facing a lot of contradictions. That's the best I can do. She seems competent.
It's interesting how some of these people become media fixtures for a long time. Certain, and there aren't very many, but certain members of the House and the Senate are on TV, these political shows, constantly.
Right. One way I know that I'm watching too much TV and somebody's on too often is if I can tell who it is just by hearing their voice.
I know what you're saying.
I had that experience once in the 90s with Bob Barr, and then I'm like, I've got to turn this off. Some people, some members of Congress seek out those opportunities more than others, and they're relatively good at speaking sound bites and keeping the right talking points on the top of their head, and so their party might ask them to do more appearances because you seem more loquacious than the next person.
Right.
There's some payoff for it from their perspective that they get a little bit more national attention.
Thanks, Jeff. Now we go to Kurt from Kenosha. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Kathleen. I have a question for Professor Coger and a quick suggestion for a future show for you, Kathleen. Mary really summarized where I'm coming from, and I thank you very much for saving me so much time because it's exactly the way I feel, the same way. I feel like it's 1930 all over again. We got 10 years of economic downturn staring us in the face, followed by a decade and a half of incredibly existential challenge, potentially just as deadly as World War II could conceivably be, and pick your choice: global warming, mass die-offs, lack of fresh water. These challenges face us. Our leaders have got to know it. They're smarter than they seem in public, and nothing gets done. And you look at Richard Shelby. There's no more proof you need that the system's utterly corrupt. For God's sake, here's a Republican trying to get you know, it's for a French company, and they hate the French, you know. and it seems like it's like Churchill and his umbrella in 1938 ago, which seems to be the only point of history conservatives are aware of. You know, here's the lesson of Chamberlain is supposedly do something before it's too late. At any rate, my question is the American constitutional system, as it's structured, possibly just irrevocably broken, and is possibly the parliamentary system the better way to go, a more efficient system of governance?
We got about 40 seconds, Professor Koger.
No, I don't think the Constitution is broken. I think we are. It is true that we do seem to be in a period where political, you know, it seems to be very difficult for our leaders to solve the problems that we all know our country faces. But I want to believe that the pressure of elections will force them to do what they think is what we all know is the right thing to do. You know, to address health care and the banking system. And the other countries are problems our country faces.
And thank you very much for the call. You are great, Professor Koger. Thank you so much for being with us. Valuable information.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and I've enjoyed the calls that we've had.
Yes, they're good, aren't they? Professor Gregory Koger at the University of Miami, where he teaches and researches American politics, specializing in the study of Congress, political parties, interest groups, elections, political history, and political institutions, author of the forthcoming, available June 2010, Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. As soon as that book is out, we'll interview him more extensively on history and the filibuster. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting show. Thanks to Chrissy Peace for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. We'll return.